This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 45 years ago, this September, more than 1,000 prisoners took over a maximum security facility in Attica, New York. The takeover came after months of mounting tensions over treatment and living conditions and led to a four-day standoff that ended when state troopers took over the facility by force. 39 men died during the retaking at the hands of state troopers, and the uprising has since become one of the most well-known moments in criminal justice history in the United States. But despite its historical significance, many of the details of the uprising have long been kept under wraps. A new book by scholar Heather Ann Thompson documents the untold story of the Attica uprising and examines how the event shaped the current politics of mass incarceration. The book is called Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Heather Ann Thompson speaks tonight in Charlotte and tomorrow at the International Civil Rights Center Museum in Greensboro, and she joins me now from partner station WFAE in Charlotte. Heather, welcome to the State of Things.
Great to be here.
Your research is more than a decade in the making. Tell us how you got started looking into this topic.
Well, I first was really interested in Attica, as your intro described it, which was a really interesting moment in criminal justice history, civil rights behind bars, an uprising, a protest behind bars that I just wanted to know more about, particularly because it ended in such bloodshed, and we seem to know really so little about what had happened in those 4 days and why it had ended so brutally. And so I decided to do the book having really no idea that the state of New York had really closed the records, made it impossible to tell the story. So it became essentially a 13-year journey to try to find the records that the state was really hoping would stay closed.
Tell us the story behind the uprising itself. What were the conditions that led to the takeover? And tell us a little bit about how the uprising was organized.
Well, Attica, New York is a tiny town, and like tiny towns across America, including in North Carolina, this tends to be where prisons are located. And this was a maximum security prison bursting at the seams. It's 1971. There's nearly 2,400 men crammed in this really archaic prison built during the Great Depression. They had insufficient food, being fed on 63 cents a day. They had one square of toilet paper a day, really terrible medical condition, medical care, lack of care, actually. And these men had tried to really work through the system to get this addressed. They wanted basic human rights behind bars, acknowledging that they were serving time, but really still insisting that they were people on the inside. And when those failed, when those attempts to send letters, petitions failed. Eventually, there is an eruption on September 9th, not planned, but quite accidental. But it ends up really bringing the world into a maximum security facility because the men ask for media and observers to oversee their negotiations with the state of New York.
Well, the outburst may have been unplanned, but afterward, as you suggest, there were organizers at a certain point who understood the importance of bringing in some fairly well-known public figures to come into the prison and see for themselves and report back to the public. Tell us about that.
Well, that's right. All prisons are so closed to the public and even remain so today. And the guys on the inside knew this and knew that in order for them to really impress upon the nation why they needed to protest, why they needed conditions improved, they needed to bring the media in to really shine a light on the inside. So once they gathered in one area of the prison, they actually elected men from each of the cell blocks to negotiate with the state on their behalf. And they brought in some high-profile observers from the media and also politicians to help oversee those negotiations. The governor at the time was Nelson Rockefeller, who had a reputation as being a quite liberal Republican governor. But what they didn't know was that behind the scenes, the governor and indeed the Nixon administration were quite determined to put this rebellion down with force.
I mean, the very fact that Rockefeller was talking with Nixon was something that, the public did not know at the time, and it didn't know for decades afterward. Am I right?
That's right. And one of the interesting things about this book was it really revealed to me, and I hope the reader, the level to which the government at every level was very, very concerned about civil rights protests wherever they happened, but particularly behind bars, and really would go to enormous lengths to make sure that they shut this protest down, even if it meant killing their own guard and civilian employee hostages in the process.
So talk a little bit about this, because, again, we should sort of paint the picture here. What the public is seeing, this is going on for 4 days, and in the paper we're seeing back and forth negotiations. People like Tom Wicker, a correspondent for the New York Times, William Kunstler, a civil rights attorney, all these people kind of going back and forth, reporting on what appeared to the public to be negotiations on ending this. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, Rockefeller is talking to Nixon about the way to end it by force, no intention at all of negotiating an end to this.
Yeah, the negotiations look like they're making headway. And meanwhile, outside of the prison, law enforcement is mobilizing. Hundreds and hundreds, indeed almost 1,000 state troopers from around upstate New York are descending on Attica, passing out weapons indiscriminately without writing down serial numbers. And in this mix, the observers say to the Rockefeller administration, whatever you do, we must negotiate a peaceful settlement. You have civilian employees as hostages there. We need to keep talking. And if you don't, it's going to be a bloodbath. And what we now know from the research is that that Rockefeller knew that people were going to die and decided it was worth going in anyway. And then actually told the nation that something quite different had happened, that in fact the prisoners had killed the hostages, which was a lie. And that would have huge implications for criminal justice history in this country.
And it was apparent from the documents that you've seen that Rockefeller understood that he had to cover his tracks. And so you talk about the weapons that were used and not registered and not documented the way they should have been by protocol, that officers were told to remove their identification from their bodies so that they couldn't be identified after the fact. Clear knowledge that you know you're going to do something bad.
Exactly. And really, I think what is really something very telling is that at the end of the day, not only were 39 men killed by law enforcement bullets, but 128 men in that yard within 15 minutes are shot very severely, some 6 and 7 bullet wounds. And then the guys on the inside get tortured for days and weeks and months. And the question becomes, as a historian, why was there never any single member of law enforcement ever held accountable for what happened on that day? And so the book chronicles what is really nothing less than a concerted effort on the part of people with the most power to make sure that law enforcement was protected.
Tell us about that. Tell us about the takeover and, again, how it happened, because you have describe for us how many troopers were involved and how the takeover, when state troopers went in to take it back, how that went.
Well, right before the Rockefeller administration agreed to send in these troopers, they first doused the inside of this prison yard with CN and CS tear gas, which is a powder. It clung to everyone's nasal passages, and they were vomiting and really incapacitated. And that's when nearly 600 troopers went in, guns blazing, shooting at anything that moved, and frankly, without provocation. In other words, the men were surrendering on the inside. But for decades, none of them would be prosecuted, because we now know that the head of the state police actually distorted evidence, removed slides, spliced film, buried evidence, and actually worked with top government officials to make sure that the stories were straight. And indeed, instead of them being prosecuted, all blame was placed on the prisoners. 62 of them were actually indicted for having rioted. None of the law enforcement were ever indicted.
Yeah, and talk about the stories that the public was told about what happened to those hostages and who the public was told killed the hostages and how they died.
Well, exactly. So remember that the media is on the scene. And even though there is a massacre that has just taken place, the state officials go in front of the media. And this is the New York Times, the LA Times, the AP news stringers, every small town newspaper, and say that the hostages were killed by the prisoners. And actually, probably more diabolically, that the prisoners had castrated one of the hostages and that there was this torture and abuse of the hostages. None of that was the case. But that story will not only sour a nation against prisoners and the need for prisoner rights, but it will also mean that very little scrutiny goes on the real perpetrators of the violence that day.
And as you said, there were reprisals that took place for months afterward, and there were lawsuits, but they took decades to work their way through the courts. In 2000, a group of inmates won a $12 million settlement from the state of New York for what they suffered. Among those inmates who won the $12 million settlement was a man named Frank Smith. He was known as Big Black. Here he is telling the creators of a Court TV documentary what happened to him.
I'm telling you, my name is being called. Where's Big Black? Where's Big Black? Get up, Black, get up. And he busted me with a nigger stick, pickaxe, and got a .38 in his hand. And I gets up, and he, bam, in my side, in my back, and made me run with my hand on my head over to the side. And before I got over there, two, three more correction officers with him now, and everybody's hitting me.
That is Frank Big Black Smith from the Court TV documentary Ghost of Attica. He's one of the Attica inmates who won a $12 million settlement from the state of New York for what happened to them in the Attica uprising. He passed away 12 years ago. I'm talking with Heather Ann Thompson about her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising in 1971 and Its Legacy. She's going to be talking about her book in Charlotte today and then tomorrow, the International Civil Rights Museum and Center and Museum in Greensboro. So all of this goes on. And as you say, there is an elaborate cover-up. Of media is told, you know, about these atrocities committed by the inmates, not about the atrocities. What I found remarkable in your book, too, was that these went on for months. Medical personnel were actually participating in the brutality, brutalizing prisoners. We're talking about doctors here who are brutalizing prisoners.
Well, that's right. I mean, what you hear Frank Big Black Smith tell you is actually the tip of the iceberg. He's telling about when he's very first assaulted by corrections officers, but he's actually forced to lay on a table for hours and hours and hours where he has been told to keep a football under his neck because if he drops it, they're going to shoot him in the head. They're dropping hot shells on him. They're hitting him in his genitals. And you can't really understand this story, this level of brutality without understanding what the stakes were in keeping it covered. That's in part because, as you say, even the doctors, the Attica doctors, two of them were contributing. They were helping to dump prisoners onto the concrete, sticking their fingers in bullet wounds. And there was also some good people. I mean, there were also medical students and doctors that showed up and desperately tried to help. But they were horrified. They were traumatized for decades after by what they saw.
But the personnel inside who contributed to the cover-up, I mean, this shows you the wall of silence that goes up when law enforcement is involved in this kind of brutality.
That's right. And that's why I hope that the book is not just a piece of history for people to consider and to read through, but also a moment for us to both to reassess prison conditions today, because they're actually much worse than they were in 71, since we did not heed the call for better conditions, and also to reconsider the way we handle police shootings today, to really understand that we need to take seriously this question of equal justice under the law, because we often don't know the extent to which law enforcement is protected.
Well, and how the investigations are conducted and who conducts them. You're in Charlotte now. Charlotte Mecklenburg District Attorney just hours ago made the announcement that Officer Brent Vincent will not be charged criminally in the killing of Keith Lamont Scott in September. Again, the judgment is in the hands of the district attorney. We won't know if that's right or wrong. But he and 15 other prosecutors came to the unanimous decision. So this leads to the question of sort of who's watching. Is there anybody overseeing the criminal justice or the prosecution, which includes the police department?
Well, that's right. And I think that you can't come away from the Attica history and not be skeptical of the entire process. Leaving aside the specifics of this case in Charlotte right now, there is no question that the very process of determining whether or not a member of law enforcement broke the law is clouded in doubt, because the very people who carry out the inquiry, the prosecutors, depend on these same members of law enforcement to make cases the other 364 days a year. And this is the same group of people investigating themselves. And at least at Attica, when that happened, we now know that there was strong evidence that members of law enforcement had actually murdered people. And yet not a one of them were ever indicted or stood trial. So we can't assume that when someone is not indicted, that that does not mean that they were guilty. And that's why the community gets frustrated. This need for equal justice under the law has still not been addressed.
We now know, after 13 years of research on your part, very challenging, very difficult to find the information. Tell us about the search just to get the documents that prove this case.
Well, that's right. I had to rely so many times on the survivors and also trying to come at this story upside down in between the lines. But ultimately, I could not have told the real story of cover-up, the real story of law enforcement culpability, had I not literally happened upon some documents that assuredly were not meant to be there. They indicated to me who had done what and when. And quite notably, those documents have since disappeared. Luckily, I got copies, and that's in my book. But it really does show you that there are there's enormous stakes here when law enforcement is involved.
Talking to Heather Ann Thompson today on the state of things. She's written a book called Blood in the Water, The Attica Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Talk about its legacy. You say it was a pivotal moment in criminal justice history in the U.S. and tells us much about mass incarceration today. How so?
Well, the legacy of Attica is really mixed. On the one hand, because of the lies told that day of the brutal retaking, it becomes an emotional fuel. Attica becomes the signal that prisoners are brutal. They all need to be locked up. We need a much more punitive criminal justice system. And indeed, it becomes sort of the emotional driver behind the mass incarceration that we're going to get. On the other hand, Attica showed that 1,300 men could stand together across racial lines, barriers of language, different political points of view, and demand that at bottom they were all people and deserved basic human rights. And that also endures. That's also Attica's legacy. And prisoners across North Carolina and Alabama and Michigan, even today on September 9th, actually on the anniversary of Attica, began protesting because that need for humanity behind bars still exists. And indeed, today's ruling in Charlotte makes clear that the need for greater accountability of law enforcement is also still with us.
Actually, I want you to go back and highlight that point that you made a second ago about the diversity. The fact is that there was a widespread, to the extent that there are widespread demographics in prison, demographically, a lot of different people from different communities were coming together for a single cause in that case. Am I right?
That's right. Whereas Nixon had one question for Rockefeller, which was, is this a black business? And when Rockefeller said, indeed, Mr. President, it is, this was all Nixon needed to know to justify the bloodshed inside. In fact, it wasn't just a black business. These were black prisoners, brown prisoners, white prisoners, and some only spoke Spanish, some only spoke English, but they managed to recognize each other as people and understood that they at least deserved basic medical care, enough food to eat while they served time. And that fundamental premise, I think, is one of Attica's most important legacies.
And that's an important legacy and a message that when people of various stripes come together, there is a possibility there. Nixon's cynical comment, of course, suggests that he knew he could get away with anything if he could blame black people.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that also resonates so much today. We know, for example, that, we have lots of people who carry firearms, even in the presence of law enforcement, and they don't end up dead. They actually end up charged. They end up being able to stand trial. So the question is, why are some people's lives less valuable or less worthy of a day in court or less worthy of human rights behind bars than others? And so, again, Attica, while it was 45 years ago, raises issues that I think we're very much still struggling with.
And Heather Thompson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And is Heather Ann Thompson, forgive me. Heather Ann Thompson is a history professor at the University of Michigan. She's the author of the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Heather will be speaking about her work at UNC Charlotte's Center City building tonight at 6:30. She is at the International Civil Rights Center and Museum in Greensboro tomorrow at 7. We have all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, how Dean Smith's push for civil rights changed Chapel Hill. We'll talk about that in a moment on The State of Things.